We are Good Charity, Bad Charity. What do?
Oh, we help and try and support charities throughout the country and abroad.
And we try and entertain you because we think charity is a fantastically interesting, diverse, controversial sometimes sector.
That tagline is getting more and more impressive with every episode, isn't it? Let's face it.
It is.
We've got a really interesting person coming in today. Deborah Alcock-Tyler is with us. She's the Chief Executive of the Directory for Social Change. We've got an awful lot to talk to her about. But first of all, we want to get a bit serious because we've been a little bit, well, is the word disquieted by some activities of large commercial organisations getting into the charity sector. Now, obviously, this is a hoary old debate that's been going on for many years. Where do you take your money from? What's clean? What's dirty? But Camilla, you've been looking at something recently, which is a bit worrying.
Denise Coates, who is the CEO of Bet365, which presumably is called that because you can bet 365 days of the year, has paid herself in 2017 £265 million. And as I was on that train from Dunedin, we were having a heated debate about if she offered us a few million of that 265, would we take it?
Just getting the balance right. I think the reason she got that much money was because when they started it, she signed a deal that said she would get a percentage of the growth. And the growth in that industry has been phenomenal.
Huge,
which is why she ended up with that money. My view is I would want to look closely at it. And if someone can try and justify it in the end result, help people who have been suffering from addiction of some sort, I'd sooner help them than just say, well, we don't give them the money.
Well, the minefield things, isn't there? Because there's all sorts of charities around who actually are there to help people who become the victims of gambling addiction, isn't there? And I see what you say. I mean, you want to drill down on the money and see what they are doing in order to make sure that people, what is the phrase? Gambling responsibly.
That's right,
The question for me is always, am I legitimising a particular type of behaviour or a way in which somebody has made money, and I'm not a great fan of betting, by taking the money? What happens when I take that money and everybody goes, well, X charity took money from them. They must be all right.
Okay, so we've got our guest coming today. She's Deborah Alcock-Tyler. She is the Chief Executive of the Directory for Social Change. Why are we interested in talking to her?
I think there are a number of things that she stands for in her own right. She's obviously been through the mill from a number of charities.
She's written a lot of books on management. Management is absolutely key. We keep coming back to it. It's not just about governance and clarity around committee structure and that kind of thing, but how you deal with people.
Yeah.
And that's what I'm interested to hear.
But she's also very outspoken about government and various other things, which I think is really interesting to see what benefit she thinks she's getting out of, you know, speaking against that.
I think we come up against this in almost every single podcast. How do we deal with government? How do we, let's say, critique government without criticizing government because we need government to be on board? Yeah. I think we'd really like to feel that government was more on our side. Again, it comes back to the thing about having a champion.
The other thing that's interesting, isn't it? We've talked a lot about the degree to which charities get involved in trying somehow to facilitate a change in our thinking or a change in society. And it's very much kind of, you know, government is thinking about this as well now. But it almost comes back to just essentially what every charity wants, something, don't they? That's got one key message. And it does, the vast majority of the time, involve a change in something which is going to help facilitate it. So whether it's a change in the attitude towards people with disabilities or whether it's a change in the way that we, as a society, cope with certain issues.
I think it's quite brave in a way that she's the head of an organisation called the Directory for Social Change. Because on the flip side of that, we're constantly, constantly being told people don't like change. So social change in and of itself, to put that in your title, is brave.
I think it is. I think for me, it's also the question of, OK, so how does that deliver on the ground to charities?
Well,
you know, that for me is one of the questions about this
organisation. And we will ask her that.
Yeah. I probably will.
Deborah Alcock Tyler has been the chief executive of the Directory for Social Change, the DSC, since 2001, and she's been involved in the charity sector for more than 30 years. Her other roles include being a trustee of In Kind Direct, a foundation set up by HRH Prince Charles, and she's vice president of the Soldiering On Through Life Trust Awards, which is an annual award ceremony for veterans and their supporters. We're also a little bit worried because she's wearing one of those newfangled watches which goes ping if your heart rate goes above a certain level and you start to get a bit stressed. So we've been warned not to ask any particularly stressful questions. Is that okay with you, Keith?
Yeah, that's fine. I try and hold back.
Good for you. Let's start off with the first notion that you would be drawn into the charity sector. How did that come about?
Honestly, no notion at all. Like most people who end up working in the charitable sector, entirely by accident, by fluke. I mean, I did volunteer when I was at school. My very first volunteering role, I was 16. And it was in those days, we called it the local old people's home. And it was literally cleaning bedpans and, you know, wiping up. It was a very tough job. What it did, I really learned from that, was that how incredibly difficult those jobs are. Because in the end, I had to stop doing it because they kept dying. And I couldn't cope with the emotional consequences of it. And so it gave me a massive respect for those people who serve the most vulnerable and the most challenged people in society. Because honestly, it's something that I found incredibly difficult to do.
But when did the spark say, actually, and do you know what, this is probably where I'd like to be in a career sense?
I needed a job and I got a job and I went to work, as it turned out, for a charity, which was the Industrial Society, then became the Work Foundation, no longer exists in that sort of form. And that was an organisation I went to where they were so passionately committed to making the world of work better for people. So it had this real campaigning zeal, this real ethos, this real about our job is about service to others and that reward for you is about what you give to others, not what you get for yourself. And I went to work for them when I was, 20, 21, and I just sort of got hooked at 20, you know.
It sounds, Deborah, like you didn't have a plan with a capital P, but that you kind of got seduced.
Yes.
And you found you liked it.
Suck
and this
it.
Is one of the things. Okay. Okay, let's put it that way. But the thing that I love about it all is it's so much fun being part of a charity. The everyday experience is completely different from anything else that you do. The people that you meet are completely different.
Yeah.
And I guess my question is, why doesn't everybody do it?
Well, I want to come back to your point later about is it fun? Because there are bits of it that frankly aren't, and I'll talk about that in a minute. But I think we have a massive problem in society, which does reflect over into charitable work, actually, that success is about scale and money and wealth and what you can have.
Numbers.
And numbers, absolutely. Yeah. Whereas, you know, voluntary endeavour and charitable endeavour is much more about... Actually, I hate the word impact. It makes me want to stamp on people's heads when they say it. But nonetheless, it is about you're profoundly changing people's lives. I mean, I wander up and down the country all the time talking to loads of small charities. And all the time I'm always saying to them, it's like, there are people out there who would not be alive if it wasn't for you. That's what you've got to hang on to. The fact that you're not paid very much, that everybody's criticising you, that, you know, apparently we're all greedy. Put that to one side and remember that you're serving people and making their lives better. And I think that trying to get that message across to people when you're young and when the whole story is about celebrity and money and wealth and, you know, it's difficult to engage.
I think that tipping point when people get involved is interesting. Mm. And at what point certain people get involved. So how does your organisation help charities to help deliver to the communities?
So what we do is we try and teach charities how to govern themselves well, how to attract volunteers, how to comply with charity law, how to raise money, who's got the money and how to get it, how to behave appropriately, how to ethically, how to get involved in the digital. So anything at all to do with running your charitable organisation or voluntary organisation, we can help you to do that.
So you're a membership organisation?
No. We're a service organisation. And again, deliberately, because one of the things we do at DSC is we basically say what we think about stuff that we think is affecting charities. And we don't want to be a membership body because we want to be able to say to the charitable sector, actually, you really cocked that up. Mm. You didn't get that right. Or you're wrong about this. Or, by the way, this is brilliant. Keep doing it. And so we don't want to be hidebound.
So who funds you? How do you make money, Deborah?
So we are self-financing effectively. So what happens is that we're in the very lucky position that we can trade in direct pursuit of our charitable object. So our charitable object is about giving information to charities. Mm. And we do that through books, through online stuff, through searchable websites, through courses, through conferences, and so we charge. But what we do, our model is one of subsidising. So some of the things we do generate lots of revenue, and that revenue subsidises the stuff that doesn't make any money. Like the training courses, for example, you know, they make a massive loss, but we subsidise that by the fact that our funding information is really helpful and it helps to subsidise that information.
What do you find that people are really looking for now? I mean, we've seen various stories which have affected the charity sector, affected our attitude to the charity sector. But since that period, you know, what have people been asking for in terms of the help that you can give them? What's their number one message to
you? Honestly, I've been at DSC for 18 years, and in 18 years it's never changed. They're always asking for help with finding funding.
Yeah.
But in the 18 years, what I've seen is... like, I've seen people from going from being quite sort of straight-shouldered and, you know, to, like, all hunched over and kind of, like hopeless. I was asked to go on the Moral Maze to defend charities. And I thought to myself, what?
Why have we come to work here where I've got to go and defend charity?
But I think it's our fault. I think we as charities, we have colluded in a lot of the crap that's been chucked at us. We've engaged in contracts when actually we should have been saying this shouldn't be a contract to the grant. We've signed up to terms and conditions that are against what we need to stand for. We've been scared. We've been afraid to stand up for ourselves. And I think that has had a negative effect. So funding, but also hope.
You talk about we're somewhat to blame because we've colluded.
Yes.
Now, do you mean colluded in taking money from organisations that we probably shouldn't have done?
Yes, absolutely.
We were just talking about this earlier.
So I'm talking now about where we've taken money from organisations that the price of taking that money has been being silent or not standing up for our beneficiaries or not saying what we need to say. It's a complex thing, actually, because in charity law, it's very difficult for you as a board of trustees to turn down money.
Mm. Yeah.
You have to have, and your reason for turning it down has to be watertight. So you can't just say, well, I didn't like their ethics. Because actually your job is to make sure you can deliver against your charitable objects for your beneficiaries. I'm talking much more about where we have taken money that's gagged us or that's stopped us standing up for ourselves.
So you say that everybody's coming to you, they want to know about funding.
Yeah.
How are they going to get more funding? What bodies, presumably, are they going to approach? Yeah. At the same time, the demand for social care and the sort of things that many charities are here for and get involved in is growing exponentially. So the next person that comes to you, Deborah, and says, right, funding, are you going to sort of put your hand on your head and crawl into a corner, which I'm sure you're not? But what are you going to tell them that gives them hope?
Well, after the weeping and the gin,
yeah.
I'm going to say two things.
Let's move on from the weeping and the gin.
I'm saying the first thing is if you look at the most stable form of revenue into the charitable sector, it's voluntary giving. Mm. It's the public literally putting their hands in their pockets and giving you money. It's so stable. So when we get these messages all the time from government saying you need to diversify or sustainable, which tends to be a euphemism for try and sell something, that's the least most sustainable source of revenue. Honestly, you can look back over not just decades, hundreds of years of charitable endeavour, and I promise you, if you are in a position where you can encourage the public to give, that's a very stable, strong source of revenue. The second thing is about there actually is a lot of money out there. It's just that we have got this self-narrative at the moment, which is about there isn't any money, and so we don't ask for the money. So, in fact, so one of the things DSC does is we research who gives money and how much they give, particularly trusts and foundations. And we were finding, trusts and foundations were saying to us that you know, in the last sort of 10 years or so, and it's been getting worse, not better, not only were people, they're getting fewer applications, people asking for less money. It's almost like they're talking, you'd think it would be the other way, wouldn't you? But it's almost like we've talked ourselves into this, well, there isn't any money, so there's no point asking.
Do you seriously believe that the government are going to fund to the same level in the social and economic climate that we had with Europe, that they're going to fund that sort of money back into the charities?
No. But this is when it comes very much to about conversations about choice. So one of the things, again, I do a lot of is talk to groups of people, which very often include the local authorities, and we talk about how you have conversations about money. So I use this analogy about the canal. So there's a canal in an area, and the local authority gets all these complaints about it because it's disused, it's got needles, and it's nefarious characters. Anyway, the community doesn't like it. It's not very safe. So they get complaint after complaint after complaint. So the local authority's got two choices. It needs to clean up the canal. So choice one is it issues a tender for someone to come and clean up the canal. So, you know, abbs.co.uk, which is a bunch of blokes with shovels, tenders, wins it, and every 3 months they go with their shovels, they clean up the canal. 3 years' time. They re-tender, and this time it's another bunch of blokes with shovels win the tender, and they go every 3 months. That's one option, and that's a transactional view of the problem. Option two is you fund the local Clean Up the Canal campaign, and you fund them to employ a volunteer manager, to buy a shed, to get the shovels, to run educational programs with local schools. And what you get is, for the same money, an entire community engaged in keeping its environment safe and healthy. So when the money goes away, the people don't. They stay there and they stay engaged and they stay committed. And that's a transformational view of how you use the money. And we in the voluntary sector, we've gotten out of the habit of helping a local authority who's giving funding to see the transformational effect of giving a grant to a local community group versus paying somebody to do a job which they're going to have to keep paying for decades to come.
But you've also talked quite publicly, you were one of another 10 signatories to a letter accusing the government of gagging charities.
Yes.
And saying that you can have this money, but you're not going to criticise universal credit or whatever it happens to be. So how does that feed into it? Because that it's all very self-sustaining and everything will out and it's all very good as long as you've got free communication, presumably.
Well, absolutely ridiculous. Why would they do that? It doesn't make any... If you're a government, you want to know what works and doesn't work, surely. So again, somehow or another, there's this kind of... There's a couple of brain cells have gone missing somewhere in that kind of thing about I want to do better for society. Because I'm not a cynic about politicians or MPs at all. I mean, I've met quite a lot of them, and most of them are really quite decent people working in an impossible system, actually. I mean, there are one or two, let's be honest. Let's not name them, but, you know, because I can't not swear with some of the names. But actually, the vast majority I've met are quite decent people working in a really, really difficult system. But something's gone wrong between understanding the point of charitable endeavour.
One of the things that fascinates me about being a trustee and I've been a chair is that I think each individual charity is a seat of power.
Yes.
I don't see it in a negative way. And we've been talking about, you know, there is a feeling of, oh, God, things are raining down on the charitable sector. But actually, charities are a counterforce. And I don't think that's necessarily about campaigning against something all the time. It's about just being.
Yes.
It's about creating something with hopefully a group of people who appreciate, understand, listen, are willing to talk to each other. And then you really can move mountains.
I completely agree. Completely.
I don't understand why everybody doesn't want to do it, because I think it's one of those things.
Well, it doesn't
things
pay very well.
It's
let's
no,
be honest.
Well, that's true. But as a trustee, you're not being paid anyway.
Absolutely,
so
yeah,
that's
true.
As a volunteer, and I've been doing this for like 15 years.
I think there's an accountability issue, isn't there? And I also think we like scare people. I mean, I think about some of the bad news stories that have been around lately. So Oxfam is a classic example, and all this sort of thing about how terrible Oxfam is. And actually, they didn't really do anything wrong. Some bad people did some really bad stuff. And, of course, the Board of Trustees didn't sit there. When it came to them, they didn't say, oh, damn, we got caught out, actually. That was one of the perks of working for Oxfam. What they went was, oh, shit, now what do we do? Do you know what I mean? So the conversations would have been about managing risk. It would have been about thinking about the beneficiaries for the future. It would have been all of those conversations. And yet the story is about how awful Oxfam is. So if you're now a trustee of Oxfam, it's quite difficult because people automatically, oh, yeah, you're the lot who did the, you know, winky eye to, like, you know, abusing or sexual abuse and whatever. And actually, that's not what happened. So I think that's one of the reasons why people don't engage in becoming a trustee. And I also think because the Charity Commission, of whom I'm a massive fan, but some of their messaging is so negative, it puts people off. It's like, you know, if you don't stand up, if you don't, you know, and completely failing to get that the vast majority of people who are trustees of charities are really good people. They're not amateurs, because you get this, I'm sure you do. There's thing when you say you're a trustee of a charity, people automatically completely forget that you might be incredibly competent, intelligent, well-educated and have a professional career. It's like, oh, bless, amateurs.
Well, this is quite interesting because we've actually talked a lot, I think, and I say, Keith, you're going to want to talk about this, but I talked about a sense of professionality about trustees, which is missing sometimes.
Yeah, the point I wanted to pick up with you, because there has to be a sense of responsibility being a trustee. You know, you can't just go, well, it's good to look on my CV.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, but it also comes down to really simple things, and we've talked about this, is what does it mean to listen? And honestly, Deborah, I don't know how you teach that. The difficulty that I have with, say, fellow trustees, not naming anybody because I have a great board at the moment, is that the feeling is, number one, I'm a volunteer. Yeah. So I want to have a good time and don't give me a hard time. Number two is I've come to the meeting.
Yeah.
I'm here.
Get me.
I'm attending. Big deal. Yeah. I'm going home now.
Yeah.
Whereas I spend a lot of my time as a trustee having cups of coffee. That's how I get to know people. That's how I then hear what they're saying. So the meeting is kind of, it's not incidental, but it's not absolutely key.
Do you know, I couldn't agree with you more. The board meeting is the least important bit of being a trustee. 90% of what boards talk about on their board meetings could be done offline via email with CC everybody. I think we've got to modernise the way in which we think about how we become as trustees. Yeah. And also it's about conversations, it's about engaging. Honestly, I couldn't agree with you more, my darling. I just like music to my ears what you're saying. But it's true. And you know,
because I'm again, a bloody good trustee.
Yes, well, exactly.
I keep telling
you. No, she's a pain in the arse.
Yeah, I bet she is. But it's because the work of the board doesn't happen in the blooming board meeting. Right.
Yeah. You sit as a chair and also as a chief exec.
Yes, okay. I've been a chair. I'm not currently a chair, but yes. Okay. Yeah.
So how do you see the experience you've had as being a chair and a trustee working better for charities out there?
So the first thing, because I think sometimes we misunderstand the role. So I see my role as a chief executive as a professional expert and advisor to my board. I've never seen it the other way around. So I don't think it's the job of the board to support me, other than, you know, the normal human support, but I'm their paid professional, just as you'd pay an accountant or pay a lawyer. The analogy I use is that of nanny and parent. Mm. So parents have this child, and for whatever reason, they can't look after it. So at 7 o'clock in the morning, they hand over the child to a nanny. Now, the thing is that because the parents aren't with the child during its most waking hours, the nanny is the expert in the child. So the nanny knows that the parents might say, I want them to have lentil soup at 11. That kid is not eating lentil soup at 11. The nanny knows that and can give that information back to the parents. Things go wrong when the parents forget that they are not the experts in their child because they're not with the child during its developing time. So they need to rely on the information and the advice that's given to them by the nanny. The nanny gets it wrong, which is the equivalent of the chief executive in my analogy, when the nanny thinks that it's their baby. It's not their baby. The baby belongs to the parents, which is the board of trustees. And when you get it right, you understand as a chief executive, this is not my baby. I might have been here for 18 years, but it's not my baby. The director of social change belongs to my board of trustees. The key thing is, it's all about the baby.
You sort of laid down a question for yourself and then you said, so we'll come back to that. Is it fun?
Yes.
Is it still fun?
Speaking specifically as a chief executive, one of my directors once said to me, forgive the language, by the time the shit gets to you, boss, it's really stinky. And there's a lot of truth to that. As a chief executive, a lot of what you're dealing with is horrible stuff. It's things that have gone wrong. It's the finances aren't right. So I think we sometimes underestimate how much of a chief exec's job is stressful, grinding, worrying about the money, worrying about all the relationships you've got to manage. Having said that, there's a massive joy in the fact that, my goodness, you can make such an impact. Like the worry about the money and the dealing with the difficult member of staff or the volunteer who you wish to heavens hadn't decided to volunteer for your charity, you know what I mean? All of that stuff is so worth it you're seeing something change in the world, you know?
What for you, though, just give us an example of something where you actually, at the end of the day, it's restored your faith.
I'm a trustee for a charity called the Berkshire Community Foundation, and last year our campaign was about funding mental health, and there was a particular individual who worked for a charity we gave a very small amount of money to. But as a result of that, we were able to do a programme that engaged with somebody who they thought they'd lost, that had fallen off the edge. And because we'd given that money, they were able to get that person back involved in a particular club that made a real difference. So that sort of thing is like hugely, hugely powerful. Or when you've got, for example, I was in Uttlesford, which is in Essex, and talking to the CVS up there, and the leader of the council happened to be in the audience, and one of the questions he asked me was about duplication of charities. Pressed all my buttons, you know what I mean? And I explained to him why there's no such thing really as duplication in charities, about free markets, all those kind of arguments that one would make. And at the end of it, he came up to me and he said, that was one of the most important things I've ever heard. And I'm now going to change the way in which I'm engaging, because I now get that I've been misunderstanding what charities are for. So that was a joyful moment for me, when you get someone to really change a perception.
Yep. Mm. There's the change.
So you now have been a chair, you're now chief exec.
Yeah.
What's the future for you?
I've absolutely no idea.
It'll grow organically.
Listen to the heart monitor.
Yeah. It'll, you know, things will hopefully it'll pay, you know, I've got no pension, so I need to earn. I'll be working until I'm 80. So, you know, there's all of that. Yeah, so in employment, hopefully, or the lottery. My strategic plan for the future is to win the lottery.
What's that, putting an application in or winning it?
No, winning it.
Yeah. Thumbs up all round. Yeah. Are we happy?
Yeah.
We're happy. Deborah, thank you very much indeed. We wish you well in wherever you go, direction-wise, and in accruing a pension, which you can be happy and relaxed with.
Thank you very much.
Isn't that fascinating? We've heard so many people from very senior positions looking at the charity sector saying it has never been bleaker than this.
Yeah.
But actually, Deborah, an extraordinary amount of optimism there. Money funding is there. We shouldn't feel beaten down. Ultimately, the transformative power of charity is still there.
It's powerful, incredibly powerful. From what I understand and what I hear on the grapevine, she has an amazing reputation in the sector. It seems like she gets everywhere, says everything, enlivens wherever she is, gives people hope and positivity. My God.
I just loved her passion. I loved the bit about that you've got to, for money, and it's an interesting concept. There's plenty of money there because a lot of people don't think there is still. But going to ask the question, but ask the right question in the right way, you know, and doing that effort and that thought process beforehand, I think is really, really strong in what's come out.
But also the idea that giving is stable.
Yeah.
Again, we keep hearing that there isn't the money. People are still giving. So people out there and in here must still be feeling positive about the sector because people are not going to throw their money away. I agree with Deborah. I think there is money out there. The trick is, where is it?
Yeah.
Who do I approach? How do I seduce them?
And isn't it a way, you know, that idea that how charities work evolves? It's not standing still. If it was standing still, then we'd all be thinking that corporate sponsorship was the only way forward, like everybody did in the 1980s. So maybe we are now getting into the climate on that, where we can say no to what could be perceived as slightly dirty money.
I think so. And charities have got to take it on board, because if local government is going to lose the sort of figures that you were talking about within the latest report, they've got to look somewhere else to try and get that money back.
I think some of the most fascinating forward thinking is coming from the charity sector. And if it has to be fascinating and forward thinking about money, so be it. And that's a great chunk of what we do as trustees. I also like the fact, in a way, oddly enough, that Deborah doesn't know what she's going to do next, because I have had this discussion endlessly with my son. I say things grow organically, and he tells me that means I don't have a plan. That's fine. I've never had a problem with not having a plan. Sometimes I think you have to just sit and think and do the research, and then you'll have a plan.
Yeah. Maybe I need to go back and sit in my little hot tub for a while and just think about it.
With a glass of rum.
With a glass of rum.
Chuck another log on the fire pit.
Yeah.
You've been listening to Good Charity, Bad Charity. We've been produced by Dan Hardoon. We're at Whistledown Studios. Our website is called goodcharitybadcharity.com. Find us on your podcast platform. Spread the word. Rate, review, and whatever you can do to pass it on to your friends. And if you feel as if you could donate to allow us to continue to create more podcasts, that's donate to create, everyone, then drop us a line too via the website. We'll be happy to hear from you.
And if you've got any ideas or any issues that you think that we should be evaluating and bringing someone in on, just let us know and we'll take it on board.
From me, David Prest.
From me, Keith Davis.
And from me, Camilla McGibbon.
Goodbye.
Goodbye.